Take a moment and recall the nativity story of Jesus, son of Mary. Joseph, the angels, shepherds, wise men, and stars. Herod was the ruler of Israel. The wise men, stargazers, possibly from Persia, told Herod of their findings among the sky stars. This is usually read in January or February, soon after Christmas. So let yourself hear it fresh in September. After the wise men left Herod, an angel appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, hurry, take the child and his mother to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you to return, because Herod is looking for the child and wants to kill him." That night, Joseph got up, took his wife and the child to Egypt, where they stayed until Herod died. So the promise came true. Just as a prophet had said, "I called my son out of Egypt." When Herod found out that the wise men from the east had tricked him, he was very angry. He gave orders for his men to kill all the boys who lived in and near Bethlehem and were 2 years old and younger. So the ancient scripture came true, just as a prophet had said. In Ramah a voice was heard, crying and weeping loudly. Rachel was mourning for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were dead. So after King Herod died, an angel appeared again in a dream to Joseph while he was still in Egypt. The angel said, "Get up, take the boy and his mother back to Israel. The people who wanted to kill him are now dead." So Joseph got up and left with them for Israel. But when he heard that Herod's son Archelaus was ruler of Judea, he was afraid to go to Israel. Then in a dream, he was told to go to Galilee. And so Joseph, Mary, and Jesus went to live there in the town of Nazareth. So that promise came true. He will be called a Nazarene. So begins the childhood of Jesus of Nazareth, later called the Christ.
Good morning. Good to see you here. My message this morning is entitled "Immigration, Racism, and Our Response." Now, sadly, the popular meme widely shared on social media every Christmas still rings true. Jesus and his family fleeing for their life from King Herod would have been turned away at the U.S. border, or at least would have been separated and stuck in cages in a detention center, perhaps for years, even though the United Nations 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees specifically bars countries from punishing people who have arrived directly from a country of persecution. So let's not forget that we are all connected. And let's also not forget that we are spiritual refugees. Not only is it our spiritual heritage, as we've just heard in today's scripture reading, but that is the reality of being a progressive and spiritual in a nation dominated by evangelical Christians. You know, after last week's message about immigration and the way the various kinds of cages our government creates in border areas intentionally destroys people's lives, forcing them into inhumane conditions and situations, many of you told me that I'm mad and I don't know what to do with it. Well, it's exactly how I felt when our group from Vote Common Good left El Paso last couple of weeks ago. I'm mad, and I don't know what to do with it. Now, admittedly, I wanted to share some of that frustration with you. I wanted us to sit with it for a week as we experience the realities of our nation when it comes to humanitarian need and humanitarian care. The reality of turning our backs on the principles of non-discrimination as described in the 14th Amendment. The reality that the spiritual and humanistic understanding that each of us are created equal has become nothing more than a historical anecdote for many of our nation's leaders, as well as a good 25% of our fellow citizens. Yes, I am mad. And I'm glad you are too. Here's the thing, though, that last part, and I don't know what to do with it, that's mostly a half-truth that we tell ourselves. And I say that for two reasons. The first is because we do basically know what to do, but we want what we can do to be bigger, to be grander, to have a more immediate impact than what we basically know to do will. And the second reason is because what we basically know to do takes quite a bit of work, takes quite a bit of consistency, quite a bit of sacrifice, and it only yields results over time and as a result of a mass of people doing the same things. So, let's start with reminders of why the work matters. This issue, which is not just a matter of immigration, it's primarily a matter of racism. This issue is a matter of life and death. As a matter of fact, you can ask the family of 37-year-old Roberto Rodriguez Espinoza. You see, 9 days after he entered into ICE custody, Roberto died. He died of a subdural hematoma. There is one primary way that happens: blunt trauma to the head. And actually, you can't ask his family, because when they tried to reach out to the Mexican embassy and Mexican authorities, as far as they can tell, he has no next of kin. The reality is that this year alone, almost 20 people have died in ICE and Border Patrol custody. The reality is that after nearly a decade of no deaths of children while in Border Patrol custody, 7 children have died in their custody since last year. And when it comes to who's in custody, well, let me put it this way. There's over 550,000 undocumented immigrants in the U.S., who are white. Care to guess exactly how many of them have been taken into ICE or Border Patrol custody? None. This is not primarily an issue of immigration. It is primarily an issue of race. Now, while we were in El Paso, we attended a congressional hearing, which, as some of you might have guessed or at least be wondering, is a really rare occurrence, because typically they're always on Capitol Hill. But we're not living in typical times, and there's nothing typical about how our government is approaching the moral and spiritual call to care for the sojourner. The hearing was held by the Subcommittee on Immigration and Citizenship, which is part of the Judicial Committee. And the subcommittee is led by Representative Veronica Escobar, an El Paso native, and as far as I'm concerned, probably going to be the very first Latino president. And she said, and as she said in her opening remarks, words have consequences. And she later added, policies have consequences. It should be of no surprise that a president who calls immigrants animals can justify treating them as such. Judicial Committee Chair Representative Gerald Nadler from New York later added to that statement, saying, instead of addressing the root cause of migration and competently managing the challenges at our border, this administration has chosen to dehumanize immigrants and to exploit this crisis for political gain. Of course, the primary reason that we had traveled to El Paso and the primary reason this meeting was being held was because of the racially motivated mass shooting in a local Walmart there. As the El Paso Times noted, both Escobar and Nadler emphasized that the racist manifesto investigators believe gunman Patrick Cruces posted online minutes before opening fire in the Walmart mirrors language that Trump has used to describe immigrants and Mexicans. The manifesto, they said, practically quoted him. Cruces admitted freely that he drove over 600 miles from his home in Allen, Texas, to El Paso for the sole purpose of killing Mexicans. And from what I heard on our trip, witnesses say that he was literally allowing people that looked white to leave so that he could get a better shot at brown-skinned people. It's something that scholars have actually labeled the Trump effect. Essentially, it is a perspective or a perceived license for aggression against people of color, particularly if they come from other nations. We're becoming a nation where increasingly the first approach to people who are different from us is cruelty. We aren't exactly the humanitarian bastion to the world that we once strove to be. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas, a firecracker of a lady, had this to say about the national tragedy. Racism, white supremacy, and white nationalism is a national security threat. At a press conference that day, Escobar had this to say: we are going to legislate. We are going to vote on spending bills. We are going to vote on reform bills. We are going to do everything within our power, including educating the American public. But ultimately, it is within the hands of the people to create change, to say that this is not acceptable. To say those of you who have stood silently or have enabled or who have emboldened this, we're done with you. Ultimately, it is within the hands of the people to create change. To say this is not acceptable. And when it comes to matters of social justice, there should never be such thing as a silent Christian. For that matter, when it comes to matters of social justice, there should never be such thing as a silent spiritualist or a silent humanist. Bottom line, when it comes to matters of social justice, if you care about anyone other than yourself, if you find value in human life, if your heart has not been hardened to the struggle of others, you should never be silent. Together, we must vision a better path forward. And if we recognize our connectedness, if we are truly in touch with our humanity, we are compelled to respond. If we can see that, if we can believe that, we should see that in our connectedness, the pain and the suffering of one is the pain and suffering of all. But if we work together, we can begin to build places of justice and peace here on earth. So how do we go about that? As I suggested earlier, for most of us, there is no single grand gesture we can make to make a quick fix of this. This is an issue that can only be fixed by grassroots movements. There's too much power and too much money to be had to expect our leaders to do it on their own. If you're not a person of color, it starts with listening to folks who have experienced systemic racism and hate. And you'll quickly learn that the idea that we live in a post-racial society is imbecilic. Listen, because anti-racism begins with respect. And as you listen, you'll probably find that you've got some personal work to do on the issue as well. That's the first step, educating yourself. It's an essential step. Learn the history of racism in the U.S. and not just what you were taught in school, but the true story of how society and its systems have consistently abused, taken advantage of, marginalized, and devalued people of color. Then help educate others. When you see something, say something. Don't be aggressive. But don't let the racist actions or words go unchecked. As Dr. King once said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And be intentional about crossing over racial divides that society tries to force on us. Attend every anti-racism rally you can. Put your time and your money into groups who help support youth of color. Be a squeaky wheel of justice to your local representatives. On every vote around matters of immigration and race, let them know your thoughts and encourage them to vote for the common good. And of course, vote. Vote for candidates who are focused on ending systemic racism. Vote for people of color because, as a percentage of the population, people of color are massively underrepresented in our government. And register people to vote. You know, the bottom line is the larger the turnout at the polls, the more likely we are to have candidates who work towards progressive values like more humane treatment of immigrants and better laws around racism. And write to your senators and your congressional representatives. Let them know that it is inexcusable that more has not been done to put an end to race-based practices in law enforcement, the jail system, the education system, as well as the media. We sometimes say we don't know what to do about all of this. But I venture to guess that no one was particularly surprised by any of the actions that I just shared with you. The truth is, we basically do know what to do, but it takes quite a bit of work, quite a bit of consistency, quite a bit of sacrifice. And it only yields results over time. But as Reverend R.H. Edwin Espy, once the General Secretary for the National Council on Churches, said, informed, concerned, and thoughtful citizens can change the world. And not only that, as anthropologist Margaret Mead, who was the recipient of the Planetary Citizen of the Year Award, as she said, never doubt a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Are there those who have thoughts that they'd like to share on the scripture or the message or just the general theme? Anyone who has thoughts they'd like to share with your spiritual community?
One of the things that occurred to me as you talked about the things that keep us from doing what we know we should is At this point in our 70s and 80s, there's an energy issue, and there's also a safety issue.
Sure.
So some of us look back and say, 30 years ago, we would have been on the front line. But at this point in our lives, we need to support younger people who are out there, like you, like some of the others here, who are willing to not be afraid for their lives.
Understood. But we can still do, at any age, we can do some of the small things like letter writing and contributing to organizations that support youth of color. Various things like that.
And speaking our concerns.
Sure, absolutely. Very much so.